In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, are eggs or salt good or bad for you? Antibiotics confusion, gluten-free diets, appetite control, the latest on testosterone, and much, much more.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
Dun 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 dun. You know, I have to have some kind of pomp and circumstance, or, you know, a drum-like drum roll leading into today's show, because frankly, I need to kind of amp it up, because it's just me, just little old me here with you today. I have no podcast sidekick. I have no Clubhouse audience. All of that kind of got shoved to the wayside. Well, frankly, because I had a technical issue with Clubhouse. Namely, I couldn't log into it for today's live Q&A, which we do a couple of times a month. And also because I was brining a turkey. Yeah, I got up early this morning and kind of ran out of time to do my official podcast Q&A. I knew it was going to be late as I hovered over the stovetop with peppercorns and rosemary and the zest of an orange peel and lemons. And what else did I put in there? Gosh, garlic, salt, brown sugar. And you heat all that up. You heat all that up in a giant pot over the stove. And then you take your turkey, and once that brining liquid has cooled off, you put your turkey in it, and you put your turkey in it for about 24 hours. That turkey just went in there about 20 minutes ago. And then tomorrow morning, 24 hours later, I'll take it out. I'll put it on the Traeger. I'll smoke it for about 4 hours at about 175 degrees with pecan pellets. And then I'll finish it off with a final roast for a couple of hours. And of course, the key here, I hope you're tuning in if you're a turkey person, the key is that right before you put it into the smoker, and right after you've taken it out of the brine, which allows you to get this super crispy skin and tender, moist inner meat, you stuff all of the inside of the skin with pads of grass-fed, grass-finished butter. Literally, like a surgeon, a chef surgeon, you cut tiny little slits in the skin around the turkey, and you stuff each of those slits with butter, just pure butter, or as Julia Childs would say, butter. And man, oh man, it's going to be a good turkey. It's pretty much exactly what I did last year, and the general consensus among my Thanksgiving Day feast attendees was that it was a good turkey. It was a good turkey. Some said it was the best turkey. Either way, it'll be good. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. This podcast is coming out a little bit after Thanksgiving, but nonetheless, at the time that I'm recording this for you, Thanksgiving is tomorrow. And I am not one of those guys who takes a whole bunch of time off over the holidays, and I wanted to get a podcast out to you because, holy cow, there's been a lot going on in the news, in nutrition news, in longevity news, and exercise news, and so I have a whole bunch of cool little things that I want to tackle with you today. This is going to be like a giant newsflash episode, and so that is exactly what we're going to dive into for today's Q&A. Now, just to give you a quick preview, we're gonna talk about eggs, whether eggs are good or bad for you, and the latest on that, the latest on antibiotics, the latest on salt, carbonated beverages and whether they make you full or whether they make you hungry, full body weight training versus body part split training, some really cool new research on ketones and ketosis and cognition and strength and power related to ketosis. We'll talk about the minimum amount of strength training you can do to stay hella strong, why you might be having a hard time putting on muscle, The latest on whether combining aerobic cardio with strength is going to impair any type of muscle building or strength gains, and even a bit of educational advice. So a whole lot going on.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong is one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order.
As I'm prone to do on Twitter, if you go to twitter.com/BenGreenfield or my Facebook page or my Instagram page, all of which I'll link to in the show notes, which you can access at BenGreenfieldFitness.com/437. That's BenGreenfieldFitness.com/437. I spend a fair amount of time each day delving through research journals and articles. I read typically 3 to 5 books every week. I gather all this information and I put it out in the internet for you to digest and assimilate through the lens through which I view it. And I sometimes on this podcast will delve into some of the takeaways that were the most interesting. And so that's what we're about to do. So let's begin with eggs. I'm not a huge fan of eggs. My sons and my wife seem to have eggs just about every day. They're kind of traditional breakfast people, eggs, bacon, oatmeal, cereal, you name it. I'm more of like a superfood smoothie guy, but it's probably good they're into eggs because we have a lot of chickens and those things just like they pop out eggs right and left. Somebody's got to eat them. So anyways, I probably have maybe 2 or 3 eggs a week. I'm not kidding. But I would say my kids and my wife probably average 1 to 3 eggs a day. And of course, if you're sitting next to somebody on an airplane and you tell them that you're into nutrition or diet or fitness or anything, they inevitably will get into something like this. Oh, I try to follow that, but I get so confused about it. 10 years ago, they were saying eggs were good for you, and now eggs are bad for you, and I don't even know, so I just don't pay attention. Well, it is true that it seems like, for some reason, nutrition research goes back and forth and back and forth on eggs. They've historically been demonized for their cholesterol content, but they're actually a pretty complex food. There's a lot of components and nutrients in eggs that will change depending on how eggs are prepared, where the hen was raised, what the hen was fed. And research shows that what you eat with eggs, you know, bacon, toast, orange juice, you name it, actually could have more of an influence on your overall health than the actual eggs themselves. And so I want to review a recent article that appeared actually on the website of our friends over at Levels, who make a continuous blood glucose monitor that I use. And they occasionally have some pretty good articles over there. But I want to give you some key takeaways from this particular article. So, first of all, eggs are good. Eggs are good. Why are eggs good? Regardless of what they're consumed with, we're going to shove that to the side for a second. Egg yolks have some of the highest dietary cholesterol contents of any food out there, about 186 milligrams in the average large egg. And that, of course, will make many people say, probably shouldn't be eating them. They're high in cholesterol, but cholesterol is complicated, right? We've got our HDL, our so-called good high density lipoprotein cholesterol. That's in most cases linked to a lower risk of heart disease and stroke. There are a few studies where rampantly high, chronically elevated levels of HDL actually appear to be correlated to high levels of inflammation and a potential increased risk of mortality. But it's very few cases in which that would be the case. In most cases, higher HDL is generally, painting with a very broad brush, better. In contrast, your elevated low-density lipoprotein, which is often associated with increased risk of mortality, particularly related to cardiovascular conditions, that one's a little bit more complicated because it's really the size of the LDL particles that matters more for cardiovascular risk than their absolute concentration in the blood. Smaller size LDL particles are more dangerous for cardiovascular disease than large particles. And those actually are the type of particles that you would see elevated in a diet that is rich in refined and processed carbohydrates, not high-fat foods. Okay, refined and processed carbohydrates, those are what you need to worry about more when it comes to LDL. The other thing that you need to bear in mind is that when you're looking at your cholesterol levels, you know, you want to look at the ratio of triglyceride to HDL, the so-called atherogenic index. That, along with your blood sugar levels and your inflammation levels, is more indicative of whether or not elevated cholesterol is going to be problematic for you. Okay. So on top of that, you know, only about 25% of your blood cholesterol levels are tied to your diet, right? Your liver and your intestines synthesize the rest of the cholesterol that's floating around in your body. And so in many cases, sometimes we focus too myopically on dietary sources of cholesterol when instead we should be focusing more on internal inflammation and whether or not any large fluctuations in cholesterol levels would be related to, say, you know, inflammation. Or something going on from a metabolic level that would be causing that to happen. So, you know, and then remember, even though cholesterol is often vilified, the body needs cholesterol to build cell membranes, to produce vitamin D, to produce testosterone and estrogen, to produce bile acids. And so when we look at eggs, you know, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services updated the dietary guidelines for Americans back in 2015. And it eliminated the previous recommendation to limit consumption of dietary cholesterol to 300 milligrams per day, and then included eggs as part of its recommended healthy eating patterns. All of this put together, even though, of course, we could talk for hours about cholesterol till we're blue in the face, cholesterol is not a reason to avoid eggs. Eggs are also a very diverse food. They're incredibly rich in a wide variety of so-called micronutrients. They're very rich in just about every vitamin except vitamin C. Yolks in particular are something that contain a very, very dense amount of these vitamins. I tell people who are ordering egg white omelets not to fool themselves into thinking that that's a healthy choice. As a matter of fact, in my opinion, that's kind of like drinking pasteurized and homogenized milk versus like a lovely local, you know, raw goat's milk that's just rich in nutrients and all the fats and proteins are bioavailable, and a lot of the bacteria and the active enzymes are still available, you know, from a clean farm. I'm a much bigger fan of something like raw milk consumption, and I consider egg whites and egg white omelets to basically be the equivalent of taking nature's perfectly packaged protein and sucking half the goodness out of it, because yolks include vitamin A, D, E, K. Your entire B complex are also concentrated in both the egg whites and the egg yolks. A couple of eggs a day provides you like up to 30% of your daily recommended amount of those vitamins. And eggs also have phosphorus and calcium and potassium and these trace elements like copper and iron and magnesium and manganese and selenium and zinc. And so especially if a hen is fed a natural diet, you know, not a bunch of like, you know, grains and corn and stuff like that, man, oh man, eggs are super concentrated in nutrients. They're a very good source of choline, which is not just a wonderful fuel for your brain, but choline deficiency has actually been linked to muscle and liver damage and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Well, it turns out that the choline in eggs is one of the best ways to fight that. And I even recommend to people, you know, and this is good for you to know around this holiday season where you might be drinking just a little more alcohol than usual. You know, choline is wonderful for managing the inflammatory or slightly toxic response to alcohol intake. So eggs are kind of a nice little thing to be having for breakfast after, say, a holiday party where you might have had a few too many glasses of wine. They have a nice anti-inflammatory benefit. And so we've got choline, we've got all of our micronutrients. Eggs are very rich in protein. About 13% of an egg is protein. Even the egg yolk has very good bioavailable protein. And so, of course, you're getting a wonderful release of satiety-based hormones like GLP-1 and peptide YY, which help you feel fuller for a longer period of time when you eat a protein-rich food like eggs for breakfast. So eggs have a lot going for them in terms of what they contain. Now, for years, you know, based on what I was alluding to earlier, nutrition recommendations have flip-flopped on eggs and cardiovascular disease. And that's mainly because eggs are high in dietary cholesterol and the story on cholesterol has gone back and forth. But the most recent epidemiological research definitely favors the idea that eggs alone are not bad for heart health. I mean, there was one 2020 study of more than 37,000 Americans over a median of 7.8 years that looked at the health impact of egg consumption and total cholesterol intake. And, you know, an earlier meta-analysis prior to that found that dietary cholesterol has only a modest association with LDL cholesterol and total blood cholesterol. But in this new study, people who ate more dietary cholesterol tended to also eat more saturated fat and sodium. So not only was the number of eggs a person consumed daily not linked to high cholesterol, but the researchers also found that eating eggs was not associated with all-cause and heart disease mortality. Okay, high total dietary cholesterol was associated with all-cause mortality, but eggs didn't seem to play much of a role with that. And remember, even when high total dietary cholesterol is associated with all-cause mortality, that's usually in a case where triglycerides are really high, HDL is low, blood sugar is elevated, inflammation is elevated, etc. And so there's been a whole bunch of meta-analyses that have been done on eggs, you know, several others, even as recently as 2020. But what all these studies suggest is that the older findings about eggs and heart health likely missed the point. Eggs alone don't negatively affect heart health, but a Western diet high in processed foods and saturated fats that may also include eggs, which is often the case, does negatively affect heart health. So if you're consuming eggs, you want to look at the source and you want to look at what you're consuming them along with. There is, when it comes to obesity, not enough evidence to draw a conclusion about eggs and obesity. The research seems to go back and forth. Some research has shown that people who ate more eggs have lower rates of obesity. Some have found that high egg consumption might actually increase abdominal obesity. But again, they really didn't look at the context of what these eggs were consumed with, right? Whether it was Denny's toast, waffles, grits and eggs, or whether it was somebody having a couple of pastured eggs for breakfast with maybe a, you know, some nice, you know, fermented vegetables on the side and a cup of coffee. In terms of the metabolic risk of eggs, and so when I say metabolic risk, what I mean by that is the interference that it might have on things like glucose metabolism and blood sugar. There's been a lot of studies on this as well. And the basic takeaway is that metabolic consequences are probably not a reason to avoid eggs. Eggs eaten in the context of a sedentary lifestyle, a Western diet high in processed foods, and smoking seems to have a deleterious effect on your metabolism, but eggs eaten as part of a balanced diet and an active non-smoking lifestyle seem to not be an issue at all when it comes to your metabolic rate, your glucose, etc. Now, the source of the eggs is, of course, no doubt, important. So a lot of research has shown that a hen's diet influences the nutritional composition of the eggs. And so what that means is that the amount of lipids and proteins in eggs of the same size more or less stays the same no matter what the hen eats. The fatty acid profile of the yolk and the egg's mineral and micronutrient content varies considerably with the hen's diet. Like, there was one review of micronutrients in eggs that showed that the selenium content in eggs can increase as much as sixfold with a selenium-rich diet fed to a hen versus a hen that wasn't fed that micronutrient-enriched diet. If the hen's diet is high in omega-6 fatty acids, then it may actually be a problem for cardiovascular health, meaning hens that are fed lots of grains and corn, you know, versus like insects and grasses and things like that, those are actually going to be higher in omega-6s and possibly more of an issue. Now, compared to caged eggs, pasture-raised eggs have double the amount of vitamin E and long-chain omega-3 fatty acids, and less than half of the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. So if you're going to get eggs, get your pasture-raised eggs. If you want a good book that really unpacks how to interpret, you know, which eggs are good and which eggs are bad, check out a book like Eugene Trufkin's Factory Farm Shopping Guide, or Liz, I think her last name is Wolf, I believe. She has a book called Eat the Yolk, which is also a really, really good way to wrap your head around how to shop for eggs the right way. The cooking method, in addition to what the hen was fed, is also important. Egg fried in butter or extra virgin olive oil, which is really high in polyphenols and flavanols that protect the oil from getting oxidized at high temperatures, or an egg fried in ghee or coconut oil or macadamia nut oil, or even like lard, is going to be far different than an egg that's cooked in, say, vegetable oil. And there are other things that seem to affect the egg, like hard boiling eggs may actually decrease the amount of bioavailable fatty acids and selenium and vitamin A. Whereas like, you know, frying an egg in a really, really heat stable oil, doesn't seem to do that same thing. So when we step back and we look at everything though, the best way to cook eggs, when we look at all the literature, is poaching or soft boiling your eggs. That yields the best nutritional value while leaving the yolk slightly raw. Okay. So runny yolk, poaching or soft boiling, if you're going to consume an egg, that's the best way to do it. From pasture raised hens, ideally. Okay. So the big takeaway on eggs is they're not going to be problematic for cholesterol or metabolism when eaten in the context of a healthy diet. You want to get pasture raised hens, fed a natural diet. That's going to give you a higher quality, nutrition dense egg. And then you want to preferably poach or soft boil your eggs rather than say like hard boiling them, or you could fry them, but you want to fry them in a heat stable oil, but poaching or soft boiling seems to be the best. Although I have to admit, I did smoke an egg a couple of times on the Traeger, literally just took the egg and threw it on the smoker at 175 degrees for about a half hour. And the egg kind of absorbs all this like smoky flavor of the pellets. And it's like a perfect soft boiled egg. So if anybody has like a Traeger grill, you should try that with your egg. It's pretty easy. You can smoke all sorts of stuff. You can smoke olives. You can smoke artichokes. You can smoke, gosh, romaine lettuce. It's pretty crazy what you can do on a smoker. So anyways, that's the skinny on eggs. Now, of course, kind of similar to eggs, we also find that antibiotics kind of go back and forth as well. And Jason Fung, a previous podcast guest of mine, recently visited this idea of whether you should actually finish your antibiotic regimen, right? Like it's that whole antibiotic treatment regimen you hear from your doctor. Don't stop taking your antibiotic until the course is over, or else you're going to get super duper sick, bro. I don't know if your doctor calls you bro. My doctor doesn't call me bro. It just sounded appropriate. So the idea here is, let me step back and just explain a little bit about antibiotics. So, let's say you go to your doctor for bacterial infection, right? Viruses, like most common colds, are not affected by antibiotics, and you're never going to see them described or prescribed in that scenario. At least they shouldn't be. But many bacterial infections lead to the use of a prescription of antibiotics, and sometimes antibiotics are even prescribed just in case, which leads to overprescription and overuse. But the exposure to antibiotics, inevitably creates resistance, right? Like high persistent levels of antibiotics lead to antibiotic resistance. Antibiotics will kill off most of the bacteria, but there's always going to be a few that are resistant. And since everybody else is dead, those resistance bacteria, which used to be very rare, are able to multiply and propagate and pass on their resistance to other bacteria. That's a well-known, proven phenomenon. Now, resistance gets transmitted by these little things called plasmids. Inside your bacteria, you have these plasmids. And these plasmids help the bacteria develop resistance, and they get transmitted to other bacteria. Plasmid DNA can be incorporated into the basic bacterial DNA so that resistance becomes like a permanent feature. Persistently high levels of antibiotic use leads to antibiotic resistance, just as high levels of, let's say, insulin from a diet rich in processed carbohydrates would eventually lead to insulin resistance. So the key to this would be to use less antibiotics. That's not a new or a controversial thought. Antibiotic resistant superbugs, in many hospitals in the U.S. have become a pretty big issue. And, The heavy-handed dosing of the latest antibiotics has led to some big problems with antibiotic resistance, like MRSA. Right? The rates of MRSA doubled in hospitals between 2003 and 2008 in the U.S. There are tuberculosis strains now that are multi-drug resistant, and there's like 10 new different antibiotics being approved currently. Now, when we look at these antibiotics, it's not the problem that we have antibiotics. The problem is that we use them too much, right? We use the antibiotics too much. And it's like giving insulin to a patient with high insulin levels over and over and over and over again. To me, it's the equivalent of like treating alcoholism with more alcohol, or treating cocaine dependence with more cocaine. And as Jason Fung notes in this article, which I'll link to if you go to the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/437, it's pretty much the same with antibiotics. And when you go to your doctor for antibiotics, what do they say? Well, they'll say, like, take amoxicillin 3 times a day for 14 days, right? How does the doctor know how long you should take those antibiotics? Are they basing that off a bunch of studies that have compared like short duration and long duration antibiotics? Well, they actually don't, right? They're following what's called an evidence-based medicine standard. That is, somebody made up a regimen of 14 days, and that's why they gave you 14 days. There's no studies that guide the proper length of treatment. It's literally just because we're guessing. We're guessing how long it might be effective to stay on this antibiotic. And so if you're feeling good, let's say you're supposed to take the antibiotic for 14 days. You're feeling good by day two. Well, supposedly, you're supposed to take the next 13 days of antibiotics as well. And that's where you get the resistance, right? 13 days of useless antibiotics when you're already over the infection to prevent resistance when you know it will actually create resistance. Now, a recent paper that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association makes the point that less is more. That paper reviewed all the clinical trials in which virtually every single time the shorter course of antibiotics was as effective as the longer ones. Okay, in almost all the cases, you could use 1/3 to 1/2 the dose of the antibiotic and get the same result, meaning about 1/2 to 2/3 less resistance, which is kind of obvious. I mean, what Jason says in his article is like, imagine you're washing your car, you wash it for 10 minutes and it's clean. Should you continue to wash it for another 60 minutes and assume it'll be more clean? Well, no. The bacteria are mostly dead. What's the point of taking more medications? And so, you know, if you need 3 days of antibiotics, take 3 days. If you need 2 weeks, take 2 weeks. But don't take 2 weeks of antibiotics if you only need 3 days. I wish more doctors were aware of this and could prescribe more wisely the use of antibiotics and educate their patients more wisely, because we'd see a lot less of this antibiotic resistance being developed if that were the case. So great article. I highly recommend you check it out. And then one last kind of like myth-based article is the salt one, right? Cutting out salt. Even the New York Times recently published an article about how cutting out even a little salt can have big health benefits. You know, and of course they cite blood pressure as the main reason for this. And it is true that, especially for those who are particularly sensitive to salt, your blood pressure can rise by like 10 millimeters or more of mercury on a typical high salt diet. And there was one Stanford University study that found that reducing about, you know, 350 milligrams of sodium per day could lower your systolic blood pressure by about 1.5 millimeters of mercury and prevent about 1 million strokes and heart attacks annually. Okay, and they found another study, like 20,000 plus people in China, showed that for people at a high risk of stroke, replacing regular table salt with reduced sodium salt significantly reduced the incidence of cardiovascular events and reduced all-cause risk of mortality. We see all of these recommendations about lowering salt consumption being beneficial for blood pressure and mortality, but here's what you need to know. Those studies are done on table salt. Those studies are done on isolated sodium chloride. I've had my friend Dr. James Nicolantonio on the show before, who wrote the book The Salt Fix, in which he spends several hundred pages detailing the idea that a salt, a natural salt that is rich in a wide variety and full spectrum of minerals, is actually going to increase lifespan and health span and not decrease it. The problem is that these studies don't differentiate between, let's say, Celtic salt or Florida cells or some other form of an amazing mineral-rich salt that is not simply isolated sodium chloride, and they don't differentiate that between just pure table salt. So yeah, table salt ain't that great. Cut it out. Like, stop using it, but use a good salt. Use a good salt. I eat about 6 to 8 grams of salt a day, folks. I've been doing that for about 10 years. My blood pressure is fantastic. It's rock bottom low. My mineral levels look great. And I attribute a great deal of that to the fact that I have a robust salt consumption habit. Now, I'd be remiss not to give a quick shout out to the salt that is probably my favorite salt. I use this salt called Kalima salt. I'll link to it in the show notes if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/437, but they hand harvest this stuff from a dry salt lagoon in Mexico. They literally protect the area. The Mexican government does protect the wildlife, they protect the water, they protect the lagoon, and as a result, this salt is free from microplastics. It doesn't have added fluoride or iodine. It's unrefined, it's moist, it's soft, it's coarse, and it tastes absolutely amazing. If you are ever out to dinner with me and you see me walking around or sitting down with my fanny pack always has a little baggie in it of this wonderful Kalima sea salt. They also, the same company that make it, they make a really good unrefined avocado oil, these amazing spice blends. They have caramelized cacao beans. They have Yucatan honey. And so if you want honey, salt, cacao beans, amazing spice blends, and avocado oil, check out these guys. I'll link to them in the show notes if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/437, but they're called Kalima salt. So check them out, and I'll link to those in the show notes for you if you want to pick up some salt for yourself. So we've tackled eggs, we've tackled antibiotics, and we've tackled salt. Now, the next thing that I want to get into is weight loss and appetite. Weight loss and appetite. So the first thing is that there was a recent study that looked at the difference between full body weight training and so-called body part split training. Now, I personally, when I was a bodybuilder way back in college, I'm a little bit of a lean gainer. I'm a little bit of what you might call a hard gainer. I have a hard time putting on muscle when I lift weights unless I do a full body strength training protocol. So when I was bodybuilding, you know, I went from 175 pounds to 215 pounds during my senior year in college. And I was doing 3 full body heavy weight training sessions per week: squats, cleans, deadlifts, overhead push press, variations of all of those, heavy bench press. And then I would have one day of the week where I was doing so-called vanity exercise, you know, calf raises, bicep curls, stuff to kind of fill in the gaps and make me look good on stage. But really the meat of my program was those 3 full body weight training sessions per day. Since that point, even though I don't bodybuild anymore, I still don't waste my time too much with these body part split type of programs where it's biceps, triceps, Monday, you know, abs and core and low back Tuesday, you know, and then like whatever, chest and shoulders on Wednesday and back on Thursday. There's all sorts of different body part splits. The reason I don't mess around with those is A, you have to sufficiently exhaust those muscle groups to the point where body part split training is effective if you're training for like 2 to 3 hours a day in the gym. But if you want the most bang for your buck from an efficiency standpoint for your training. All right. So the next thing related to the whole weight loss thing was a paper on my friend Tucker Goodrich's website. It was a paper that looked into what are the most fattening foods. What are the most fattening foods? You know, they looked at fruits, vegetables, nuts, you know, whole fat dairy, low fat dairy, you know, whole grains, trans fats, processed meats, unprocessed meats, et cetera, et cetera. And when you look at all the data, when you step back and look at all of the data of the 4-year weight change associated with foods that were consumed over a 4-year time span amongst about 121,000 U.S. men and women, the food that appeared to cause the greatest increase in weight gain were basically, well, the top three were potato chips, potatoes, and sugar-sweetened beverages, you know, like soda. And so, obviously, the top two were potatoes, right? Potatoes are the most fattening food. Boom. Done. Right? Well, the problem is that if you actually delve in and you access the paper and you look at the studies, what they did was when they said the potatoes were the most fattening food, if you look at it, they have both French fries and boiled, baked, or mashed potatoes lumped into the same group. And then potato chips are grouped separately. Now, if you actually look at the French fried potatoes and the potato chips versus the boiled, baked, or mashed potatoes, it's like there's you know, the graph is undeniably obvious that it's the potato chips and the French fried potatoes that caused potatoes to be rated as the most fattening food, right? And of course, the reason for that is that, you know, if you turn, you look at whatever the ingredient of the average, say, you know, Lay's potatoes, the ingredients are potatoes, right? On like, let's say, McDonald's, right? Let's say like a McDonald's French fry, right? McDonald's French fries are potatoes, vegetable oil, canola oil, corn oil, soybean oil, hydrogenated soybean oil, wheat and milk derived natural beef flavor, dextrose, and then a bunch of preservatives like sodium acid, pyrophosphate. And then if you look at like Lay's potato chips, it's potatoes, you know, vegetable oil like sunflower, corn, or canola oil, and salt. Well, we absolutely know, and I've covered this on the podcast multiple times before with multiple guests, that oxidized seed oils and vegetable oils and the inflammatory response to them and the presence of what's called dietary linoleic acid, which elevates things like anandamide, which causes you to have an addictive reaction to that food, causes inflammation, induces obesity. Those are the reasons that potatoes are ranked as the most fattening food. But when you actually look at other data on potatoes, potatoes are also the most satiating food and happen to be pretty nutrient dense, chock full of minerals, and very affordable, right? And so when you see articles like this that say, you know, newsflash, potatoes are the most fattening food, always step back and kind of like the eggs I was talking about earlier, ask yourself, well, what are you talking about? Where did the potatoes come from? How were they cooked? What were they cooked in? And as a matter of fact, the weight gain response to boiled, baked, or mashed potatoes is actually pretty low. It's French fried potatoes and potato chips. And I just thought this was interesting to mention because, man, the media, it just ignores so much these subtle nuances that are, in fact, quite, quite important subtle nuances. So I'll link to that article. It's on the Yelling Stop website if you want to look at the data yourself. But potatoes are not the most fattening food. It still stands that the most fattening food is really fried foods that contain carbohydrates and soda, right? Nix those from the diet, and it's not just your weight that's going to respond favorably. It's pretty much every freaking, you know, metabolic risk factor on the face of the planet is going to respond accordingly. Now, speaking of soda, carbonated beverages, I'm a huge fan. Like I have this thing where I have in my bag everywhere I go, I have like Omica Organics. They make a stevia. This company makes like a nice organic stevia. I have the vanilla flavor and the butterscotch toffee flavor of that stevia. And whenever I'm traveling, whenever I'm at a restaurant or whatever, I order a Topo Chico or a Pellegrino or a Gerald Steiner or any other fancy foofy sparkling water. I put a dropper full of that stevia in it, and it makes it taste like a vanilla or a butterscotch toffee flavored cream soda. I give this to people sometimes when I'm out to eat with them, and they're like, holy cow, this is a game changer. I'm never going to drink a soda again, because it literally just takes sparkling water and makes it into the most amazing and satiating, in my opinion, drink. So I drink sparkling water and chew gum a lot during the day as a way to keep my appetite satiated and keep me from mindless eating, which is also important because I have a home office. The refrigerator is like always within 100 feet, always chock full of amazing foods and, you know, dark chocolates and nut butters, etc. I could eat all day long if I want to, but I don't. I eat two or three times a day, you know, typically space my meals 4 to 6 hours apart and, you know, do a 12 to 16 hour daily intermittent fast. But gum and sparkling water are two things that I consume in those in-between times. But a lot of people ask me, well, does soda water actually fill you up? And a recent study kind of threw a wrench into this equation, because what they did was in rodent models, right, they tested their levels of an appetite-stimulating hormone called ghrelin after ingestion of carbonated beverages versus regular degassed beverages or tap water. And what they found was that in the rodent models, and then they went on to try this out in healthy human males, that levels of ghrelin actually increased, which could potentially increase appetite and induce weight gain. But then when you look at another study, what they find is that when the stomach expands in response to carbonated beverages, you get a release of what's called cholecystokinin, or CCK. And CCK is actually something that makes you feel full. When I go and I look at these studies, what it appears to be is that if you're drinking enough sparkling water to where it actually kind of expands your stomach, like, you know, let's say like the average bottle of Topo Chico, or say a half bottle of those big old Pellegrinos you might find at Whole Foods or the grocery store, it's the volume of that sparkling water that matters. Like, if you drink enough sparkling water to where it's kind of expanding your stomach, it appears that you get a release of cholecystokinin that would cause you to be more satiated. If you're sipping on little bits of sparkling water here and there, though, it might actually cause ghrelin to be increased, which would increase your appetite cravings. So it's really, really interesting nuance. It's like, if you're going to drink soda water to keep your appetite satiated, drink enough to where you feel like it's not like bloating you, but is at least making you feel full. Like, don't just take tiny sips on it. Instead, it appears that just like having a big bolus, like drinking a whole Topo Chico, right, all at once, is going to keep your appetite satiated for a longer period of time. And not only that, but taking small sips of a sparkling beverage throughout the day may actually increase your appetite. And that's good to know, right? So if you're going to drink sparkling water, drink it like drink a whole bunch, you know, like have 16, 20 ounces or whatever, and then don't drink again for a little while, because obviously you don't want to be peeing all day or get hyponatremic from too much water. And then, you know, have another bottle. But basically, it's the volume of consumption that appears to matter the most. So a couple interesting studies. And again, I'll link to those if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/437. Now, another one related to fat loss. This is a good little tip for you over the holidays, especially. New study shows that hourly 4-second sprints prevent impairment of postprandial fat metabolism from inactivity. Okay, what this means is that a 4-second sprint duration, in this case, they used a bicycle. You could use any type of ergometer. You know, you could do burpees, jumping jacks, you name it. But once per hour, a very short bout of 4 seconds in duration, okay, that was done in subjects who were being interrupted during 8 hours of prolonged sitting. They saw significant lowering of the next day's response to high food intake and an increase in fat oxidation after a high fat meal. So that means that the benefits of getting up every hour and doing 4 seconds as hard as you can go is not only going to be good for you metabolically on that day, but even into the next day, reduce the propensity of a meal to basically increase your triglycerides, increase your glucose, or it would also increase your ability to be able to oxidize fat. So this is pretty cool. I mean, I have a treadmill workstation. I walk a lot when I'm working and doing calls and stuff during the day. And many times I'll throw in a little sprint on that treadmill. Now, my treadmill is, I took one of these TrueForm treadmills, which is like a super nice running treadmill. It's not one of those dinky little 3 miles an hour, you know, desk-based treadmills. It's actually a full-on, like, gym type of treadmill. I took the front dashboard off so my laptop and my computer could be in front of it, and I'll walk on that and then sometimes run. There's another company that's kind of cool. It's called Ergonomix. I'll try and find a link and link to it in the show notes. They literally make a stand-up desk. I actually have one. It's out in my garage. I didn't even set it up yet. It's been sitting out there for a couple of weeks, and it's something I'm super excited about getting set up. I think it's called Ergonomix, I believe. I'll hunt it down and see if I can get a link and a code for you guys in the show notes. But it's one of those stand-up desks that has a built-in ergometer underneath the desk, meaning you could like pedal and exercise while you're working. And that's another perfect example, you know, just like a kettlebell on the floor of your office or a pull-up bar in the door of your office, of how you can easily weave in these 4 second sprints every hour. And I mean, it's a total no-brainer. You said 4 seconds? It's a shockingly short period of time. So, you know, another example would be like this latest artificially intelligent power. They call it the Carol bike. That's like a 9-minute workout where you do 2 20-second sprints during the workout. I actually have one of those too. It's out in my gym. And that's another perfect example. Like sometimes it's pretty shocking how little you actually need to exercise. If it's a super high intensity burst, like, you know, running from a lion or chasing down a gazelle, I suppose, because I know all of my listeners run down lions and chase down or run away from lions and chase down gazelles. Perfect example of how simple this stuff can be. 4 second sprint. So, that's what I have for you as far as the weight loss and the appetite pieces. And so what I want to do is move on now to some cool new stuff related to nutrition. This next study was on ketones. What they looked at was the effects of ketone consumption, like not getting into ketosis or drinking MCT oil or C8 oil or coconut oil or a high-fat diet, but literally like drinking these new ketone supplements. They call them beta-hydroxybutyrate. So they wanted to see what the consumption of beta-hydroxybutyrate would do from a cognitive standpoint, whether it would actually, as they hypothesized, elevate cerebral blood flow and BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is like Miracle-Grow for your brain, as well as improve cognition. Now, these were in obese individuals that they did this study on, but I have a strong hunch, just looking at the physiology of ketones, this would apply to just about anybody. Now, what they found was that people who consumed these ketone supplements, they actually saw an increase in blood flow to the brain, cerebral blood flow, an increase in brain-derived neurotrophic factor, protection against obesity-related cognitive dysfunction. And all they were doing was they were supplementing with beta-hydroxybutyrate 3 times a day. Okay, so maybe you could do it right after you do your 4 second sprint. Serving of about 12 grams, which is around 30 milliliters, which is an average size of beta hydroxybutyrate. And then they had a group doing a placebo drink that probably tasted like rocket fuel, because a lot of these beta hydroxybutyrate supplements, they don't taste fantastic, but man, oh man, they are like a shot in the arm for performance, for appetite satiation, and in this case, pretty significant impact on cognition when it's kind of microdosed throughout the day. I have been experimenting with this new form of an exogenous ketone. It's called R13-butanediol or R13-BDO. So it's a very cost-effective way to increase blood beta-hydroxybutyrate levels and get you into an optimal ketone range for the performance or for the recovery or for, in this case, now that we know, the cognition, keeps you in ketosis for a longer period of time. And this one I got from my friends over at HVMN. It's called their HVMN Ketone 2.0. I'll link to it in the show notes, but it actually doesn't taste half bad And it's like this new form of ketone. It's not the form that they tested in this study. I honestly think it's even better. It's probably the best ketone supplement I've ever tried in terms of the actual results that I get from it. I got a big bottle in my fridge now. I've been hitting it a couple times a day, just a couple little sips. And man, oh man, it's a cool form of a ketone called R13-butanediol. Another good company that makes good ketones is called Ketone Aid. And then finally, there's one called Oxford Nutrition that does a really good ketone ester. So if you're not yet on the ketone bandwagon or experimenting with these exogenous ketones, not just for cognition, but also for performance, for recovery, for appetite satiation. I mean, you could literally, like, not that you'd want to do this because turkey's great, but you could take a shot of this before your Thanksgiving dinner and you'd be eating because you're like obligated to be with people, not because you want to. Like, I can literally like wake up fasted, do a shot of this stuff and not be hungry till like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's nuts. You almost have to be careful because you don't want to get into a calorie deprived state because you're not hungry. But it's pretty interesting, these ketone monoesters and how well they seem to actually work. And I'll link in the show notes that new HVMN ketone and the Oxford ketones and the Ketone Aid ketones. I mean, they're all three a little bit different, but all three of them work. I have all three in my pantry, and ketone esters are just they're amazing. Like they're a true game changer. One other study on ketosis, though, because I get asked this question, well, what about if you're like an athlete competing in highly glycolytic events, you know, like if you're a CrossFitter or you're a triathlete and you need the carbohydrates, aren't you going to see that ketones would impair things like resistance training induced muscle hypertrophy? A lot of studies have been done on ketones. The general consensus is that if you're engaged in a sport that requires you to be very glycolytic, meaning exercising at a hard pace for more than about 30 seconds for multiple efforts, then you'll need a decent amount of carbohydrates to be able to fuel or recover from those efforts. But if we're talking about short, explosive type of things where you're primarily using creatine, you don't need to focus as much on the carbohydrate consumption. And in this latest study looked at what a ketogenic diet does for body composition and for strength. Well, this latest study basically found that you actually, it was a review of 9 different randomized control trials, right? And what they found was that they looked at body composition, strength, and power in response to a ketogenic diet. So with regards to body composition, they found that a ketogenic diet could reduce your body weight and your fat mass, but also reduce your fat-free mass compared to a non-ketogenic diet, meaning it's a little bit harder to keep muscle on, it appears, with a ketogenic diet. And so what they found was that a ketogenic diet was a beneficial strategy for promoting fat loss. No big surprises there, but it might not be the best recommended option if your pure goals are to gain muscle mass and to gain strength and to gain power. And I see this over and over and over again. People will come to me and they'll be like a hard gainer or, you know, a skinny guy who's trying to put on muscle and they're doing the whole high fat, low carb thing. And all that I'll do is I'll a lot of times not recommend a high carbohydrate diet to someone, but I'll recommend these carb reefies. And this is exactly what I do. Like, I maintain pretty decent amounts of muscle and low amounts of body fat. I'm usually in ketosis all day long, and then I'll have anywhere from 100 to 200 grams of carbohydrates with dinner, sweet potato, yam, you know, red wine, dark chocolate, you name it. And what that does is it allows you to bump up and top off your glycogen levels, be in ketosis all day, be out of ketosis in the evening, and then jump back in the next day. That's a really beautiful scenario in my opinion. And then I also have one meal per week, typically a Saturday or Sunday, where I just don't pay attention to carbs at all. I eat as many as I want. So I might have, you know, a couple pieces of pie or, you know, an extra glass of wine or a whole bar of dark chocolate or a couple of sweet potatoes or whatever. And that actually does a really, really good job staving off any type of long-term thyroid dysregulation in response to a long-term carbohydrate deprivation. But these two recent studies, basically the takeaway is that sipping on a ketone ester during the day makes you smarter and or at least improves cognition and blood flow to the brain and brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And a long-term hypocaloric ketogenic diet may actually cause an impairment in your muscle mass gains and your strength and your power performance-based metrics. So just make sure you're aware of that. And my recommendation is to do more like cyclic ketosis and a little bit of a carb refeed at some point during the day and then a weekly carbohydrate refeed. And I would recommend the carb refeed be done in the evening because that's going to increase your serotonin levels, which will amplify your melatonin levels and result in a little bit better sleep. And if you're concerned about your blood sugar being elevated in response to that, do some cold thermogenesis or a strength training session prior to your carb feed in the evening, and you'll see a really nice blood glucose response. You could also use what's called a blood glucose disposal agent. You know, my company, Keon, we make a good one called Lean. Berberine is an option. In a pinch, you could just use apple cider vinegar or Ceylon cinnamon, or if you're out at a restaurant, a splash of house bitters from the bar on top of some sparkling water with a squeeze of lemon. So there's a lot of different ways to bump up your blood glucose disposal agent status, but that's what you'd want to do prior to that evening carbohydrate refeed. All right, next let's talk gluten. Who doesn't like to talk about gluten-free diets? Three interesting studies on gluten-free diets, So the first study actually looked at whether a gluten-free diet could result in nutrient and micronutrient deficiencies. It was called nutritional imbalances on a gluten-free diet. Well, it turns out that even though this study was done in celiac patients following a gluten-free diet, a strict gluten-free diet did cause notable deficiencies in a variety of different micronutrients like iron, calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, vitamin E, some of the B vitamin groups. And that's not surprising because in many of these, you know, micronutrient rich, you know, grains, you know, quinoa, amaranth, millet, even wheat, you know, I don't vilify wheat. I'm not a fan of glyphosate and, you know, wheat that's been bred for high yield crop just because it's a little bit more concentrated in the gluten protein. But ultimately, I'm not against properly prepared, soaked, sprouted, you know, fermented, et cetera, grains. But if you're cutting all of those out, you do increase your risk for micronutrient deficiencies. Now, that's not to say you can't properly comprise a gluten-free diet to be nutrient dense, but you do need to be more careful if you're eating a gluten-free diet. Now, there was another study that looked into this in non-celiac-based patients, and they found that the gluten-free diet actually worsened the quality of the diet and increased its inflammatory potential. And this is probably because if you look at a whole bunch of these gluten-free foods out there, it's usually like high glycemic index carbohydrates, you know, like made up breads and you know, rice-based starches and all these things that are like low nutrient dense, low fiber alternatives to gluten-based carbohydrate sources. This particular study found, kind of like the other study, a reduction in a wide range of micronutrients in response to a gluten-free diet, and also a reduction in the intake of fiber, vitamin B1, B6, B12, folate, and that nutrient imbalance caused by a gluten-free diet in this study led to an increase in what's called the dietary inflammatory index, suggesting that a gluten-free diet has high inflammatory potential. Again, potential. You could have a properly comprised gluten-free diet and be just fine. But it turns out you need to be very, very careful with it. Kind of like veganism. Like, you can have a properly comprised plant-based diet that gives you everything you need, but you got to be careful to soak and sprout and ferment and combine different plants to get your full protein profile. And it appears to be the same with a gluten-free diet. Now, the third thing that I want to mention to you, this is important because a lot of people have irritable bowel syndrome or stomach issues or gut issues, and that's the reason that they choose to do a gluten-free diet. Now, this is kind of sort of old news because it's come up multiple times in previous studies, but it just popped up again in a recent 2021 study. When you look at the effect of a gluten-free diet on gut stability, in many cases, it's the reduction in what are called FODMAPs, right? Fermentable oligo, dye, and monosaccharides and polyols, things like apples and onions and garlic. Those are what cause the bloating and the IBS. And in many cases, a low FODMAP or a FODMAP-free diet, and you could just Google high FODMAP foods and cut those out of your diet if you have irritable bowel issues, those beat out a gluten-free diet. So it appears that the benefits of a gluten-free diet in many cases when it comes to controlling things like irritable bowel syndrome is not the reduction in gluten per se, but the fact that you see a reduction in these fermentable foods, the FODMAPs. So I think that in many people who are following a gluten-free diet so that they get less bowel issues, I don't think the issue for them is eliminating gluten unless they actually have shown that they have celiac disease or severe gluten intolerance. Instead, the issue is that they're eating these fermentable foods like the FODMAPs. So my recommendation is cut FODMAPs and try a low FODMAP diet before you try a gluten-free diet. And if you decide to go with a gluten-free diet, these other studies demonstrate that it's a really good idea to take a multivitamin and to get your bases covered from a micronutrient standpoint. And again, the nutrition imbalances that were reported across multiple studies in adults and children from several countries who followed a gluten-free diet for varying lengths of time were a low fiber intake, low presence of vitamin D, E, the full B complex, low intake of iron, calcium, magnesium, and zinc. And so you do want to be careful if you're following a gluten-free diet just to make sure that you properly comprise that diet. And I highly recommend you try a low FODMAP diet first. And then one other thing related to diet, one last one related to diet, and this was a testosterone study. What they did was they looked at the effects of dieting on testosterone concentration in men, specifically caloric restriction. Okay, and it makes sense that if you're sending your body a message that calories are not readily available and you might be in a time of, you know, from an ancestral standpoint, say like starvation or famine, nature wouldn't want you to bring babies into the world in a situation like that. And so you'd see a decrease in your total testosterone or your free testosterone concentrations. If I'm looking at the lab results for myself or someone who I'm working with, and I see very elevated levels of what's called sex hormone binding globulin, SHBG, and low testosterone, in most cases, when I do some digging, that person is not eating enough food and or not eating enough carbohydrate. And when we adjust that and get more food into the diet, SHBG decreases and testosterone increases. And this study showed a significant decrease in total testosterone concentrations in normal weight, healthy men who were calorically restricted. I would say maybe because you have more bioavailable fat stores to rely upon if you are overweight or obese, that might not be the issue. But if you're the average, healthy, lean guy, and you could probably extend this to a certain extent to the endocrine system in women, who's calorically restricting and dieting and then complaining about your testosterone levels, eat more food. Eat more food and sometimes eat more carbohydrates. For example, using that strategy that I talked about earlier. And if you do a lab test and you see that you've got increased sex hormone binding globulin and decreased or low testosterone, in most cases, it's either not eating enough food, not eating enough carbohydrates. And then if you look at those results and cortisol is very elevated, then in some cases it can also be a stress issue, because similar to nature not wanting to bring new babies into the world during a time of famine or starvation, the same could be said for a time of excess stress. So again, this latest study once again shows something we see over and over and over again. You want to amplify your libido, your testosterone, your sexual performance, etc. Make sure that you're not excessively caloric restricting, excessively restricting carbohydrates, or excessively fasting. All right, so now we're going to move into a few takeaways for exercise. So this first one looked into the minimum amount of strength training that you can do to stay strong, not necessarily to maintain muscle mass, but to stay strong or to even increase your 1RM strength. Now, due to their efficiency and their effectiveness in increasing total body muscular strength, multi-joint exercises like the ones I was talking about earlier, like the power lifts, like the squat and the bench press and the deadlift, those are widely used by active individuals as well as athletes in their pursuit of increasing strength. They're just proven. They work really, really well. But what's the minimum amount of those you would need to do to actually maintain or even increase strength? Well, this latest analysis looked into 2,629 studies, right? Big systematic review. And they found, drumroll please, performing a single set, one set of 6 to 12 repetitions to failure 2 to 3 times a week can produce significant increases in your 1RM strength, even if you're a trained individual. Okay, I'm going to say that again. One set to failure of 6 to 12 repetitions, 2 to 3 times a week. Meaning literally, you could maintain decent strength levels by doing one set to failure of the squat, one set to failure of the bench press, and one set to failure of the deadlift on a Monday, a Wednesday, and a Friday. And this was over an 8 to 12 week time span, so a decent time span. Didn't see a drop off in strength at all. And so it's good to know, especially for people who are going through a period of time where they might be a little more time hacked, but don't want to get, you know, weak, for example, that you can just drop in, you know, 3 different exercises, 3 sets, 2 failure, and maintain strength. So, you know, that it's kind of related to one form of exercise that I tend to program a lot. You know, I have like this whole fitness program in what's called the Ladders app. That's my app where I deliver workouts to you each week. And I'll link to it in the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/437. But as a key part of the workouts that I program within that app, I have a super slow resistance training protocol, right? It's chest press, shoulder press, row, pull down, leg press. One single set, super slow, like 30 seconds up, 30 seconds down for 5 to 10 reps to absolute failure. That's a perfect example of like a 15 to 18 minute workout you could do on a Monday and a Friday and stay very strong with just that workout. So kind of cool, especially for those of us who like to hack time. There's another really, really interesting paper I came across called Anabolic Resistance of Muscle Protein Turnover. New paper, relatively new, 2021. What they looked at were all the reasons that people might have a hard time putting on weight. It's technically called anabolic resistance. Okay, that's a term often used to describe a decrease in the quality or the quantity of a particular muscle protein pool, namely the myofibrillar proteins that are found within muscle. And those myofibrillar protein synthesis rates are indicative of whether or not you're going to be able to put on muscle or whether you might have this so-called anabolic resistance. So what they looked at was they looked at what might actually cause a decrease in muscle protein synthesis, right? What might cause a decrease in the ability of the body to be able to use amino acids to build muscle? Now, if you go and listen to my podcast with Angelo Keeley that I recently did and that I'll link to in the show notes, we talk about the amino acid composition of a variety of proteins and which ones tend to be better at anabolic signaling, like leucine, for example, which we put into our chion aminos in higher amounts recently. That's probably the most potent anabolic signaling molecule that exists. That's an example of an amino acid that you'd want to have in high levels in your bloodstream, especially during resistance training, if you wanted to stave off anabolic resistance. But there's some other interesting things that could cause you to be able to put on less muscle. The first one is obvious. It's age-related anabolic resistance, right? It's been shown repeatedly that there's a decreased response of muscle protein synthesis to protein ingestion in older adults when compared to their younger counterparts. And older adults in most studies range anywhere from about 40 up to around 60 years old. That's where you actually see a lot more effort being needed to put on or maintain muscle. Now, dietary strategies that have allowed that to not occur or to occur more slowly include fortifying meals or supplementing with leucine, increasing the protein content of each meal, supplementing with omega-3 fatty acids, and even manipulating food texture, right? Like using more blending, chewing for a longer period of time, pureeing, cooking to increase the availability of the protein. But that resistance to anabolic stimuli that is caused by increased aging, of all the things that seem to work best for it, it would basically be higher protein ingestion. Higher protein ingestion, higher amino acid intake. And that's why I recommend for older individuals who want to maintain muscle, consume like a really good protein digesting enzyme with each meal that contains protein. Like look at your digestive enzyme supplement and make sure it has large amounts of protease in it. In many cases, also adding hydrochloric acid can be good. There are good supplements out there, like Thorne makes one called Biogest. You could just pop like three of those before each meal and get your protease digesting enzymes and some HCL-like digestive support. You could also stack HCL on top of that. But basically, older adults who maintain their strength training and adhere to a high amino acid and high protein intake seem to be able to stave off that amount of anabolic resistance. People who are obese, it appears that the inflammation caused by excess fat tissue impairs muscle protein synthesis. So in a way, simply losing weight, losing fat, even prior to going into like a mass gain or a muscle building phase would allow you to put on muscle more easily. You know, like going through a phase where you're doing like fasting, cold thermogenesis, caloric restriction, all those things you can do to decrease fat. And then from there, once you've burnt off some of that fat, the actual process of gaining muscle is going to be a little bit easier, which is nice too, because it's hard to like eat the amount of protein and eat the amount of calories and do all the things necessary to put on muscle while simultaneously dieting and trying to lose fat. It's difficult to combine the two. You could do it, but it's more difficult. So my recommendation to people who just like have, let's say, a year-long goal to get more muscle, to just redo themselves from an aesthetic standpoint, think about losing the fat first if you're obese and then going into the strength training or the heavier amounts of strength training, and you'll probably have an easier time putting on muscle. The article also goes into some catabolic diseases that could cause an impairment in muscle protein synthesis or cause muscle wasting, you know, things like renal disease, end-stage renal disease, or the health of your kidneys is going to have a pretty big impact on your ability to be able to gain muscle. Cancer, obviously, would be another one. You know, most people know if they've got something like kidney failure or cancer, and that's probably like at the top of the totem pole for anabolic resistance is actually kidney failure. In this study, it was shown to be kidney failure, but the other ones are obesity, not exercising enough, aging, and then low intake of protein and low intake of amino acid.
So the overall takeaway, all said and done, is that, you know, if you're having a hard time putting on muscle, you may want to check out this article, but really it comes down to losing weight, getting your kidneys checked out, not engaging in sedentary behavior. If you're aging, making sure you prioritize your protein intake, digestive enzymes, amino acids, collagen, and then just staying healthy and physically active. And for the people who aren't trying to go from, you know, skinny guy on the beach to Arnold Schwarzenegger, those are usually the reasons. If you're trying to go from skinny guy on the beach to Arnold Schwarzenegger, then the answer is probably you're not taking enough testosterone and you're not on the SARMs and the peptides and the crazy overpriced nutritional post-workout supplements. And, you know, that's a whole different story. It's not to say it's not something you pursue, but for the average person, that's the low-hanging fruit. All right. And by the way, if my voice sounds different, it's because I was about halfway through telling you about that study, or almost done telling you about that study, and I somehow had this loss of my audio. So I kind of am trying to jump back in and keep rolling with you here. So sorry if that was a little bit of an awkward transition, but I got another one to tell you about. Just a little bit more here. There's always been this thing in exercise science literature that has questioned whether or not we should train for cardio and train for strength at the same time. You know, like the classic go to the gym, because I do this sometimes. I'll go to the gym or go to my home gym, and I'll do like a set of, like a chest press, a shoulder press, a row, a pull down, and, some kind of like a leg press or a squat, and then I'll do like 2 minutes of hard cardio, then go back to the beginning and do that again. Or I'll do that as like a super slow strength training protocol where I'll do one single set to failure, right? Like we were talking about earlier, and I'll do the single set to failure chest press. And then shoulder press, and then, you know, row and pull down and leg press, but I'll sandwich that in between, like, say, a Tabata set, like 20 seconds hard, 10 seconds easy, 8 times through for a super hard 4-minute set at the beginning and at the end of that strength training. Those are a few flavors of what people do when they combine like cycling or running or elliptical or rowing machine or stair step or anything like that, but kind of like sprinkle that in with a cardio, or even do their strength and then do cardio like right after, or do all their cardio before and strength right after. And so the question is, does that compromise your ability to be able to put on or maintain muscle or even develop maximal strength? Well, you know, the consensus for a long time has been it probably takes away from that. But, you know, there was a recent meta-analysis, a systematic review and meta-analysis that looked at 43 different studies across exercise science literature. And basically the conclusion that it came to was that for people who are even trained, right? People who are even trained, which sometimes, you know, the difference between untrained and trained tends to be different sometimes in literature. But regardless of training modal or training status, it turns out that training aerobic and strength training at the same time doesn't seem to compromise any of the efforts that you're making for muscle hypertrophy or maximal strength development. The only thing it hurts is power, right? So if you're training for tennis or soccer or some super plyometric powerful activity, then it would behoove you to separate any cardio training from strength training. And frankly, if you're in one of those sports, you shouldn't be doing much cardio training anyways, just because it converts some of that fast twitch explosive muscle into slow twitch muscle. But for most people, doing aerobic and strength at the same time is not only a hyper efficient strategy for your fitness, especially if you are only going to the gym or working out once per day, but it also turns out it's not really going to hold you back that much in the strength or in the hypertrophy department. So lo and behold, there's a little time hack for you. There's a little time hack for you, and I'll link to that study in the show notes. Speaking of time hacks, we're gonna do a super quick kind of like one, I don't know if it's called a 180 or reverse. We're just delving into a whole new category here, baby. I'm trying to segue, but I'm doing a bad job of it. I stumbled across an amazing website run by a pretty brilliant guy named Michael Saylor. Michael Saylor is kind of like a modern economist, and I think he's an author too, kind of like a modern day philosopher type of guy, Bitcoin investor. I think he has some like 17,000 Bitcoin, which is probably how he afforded to create this website, because it is a host of amazing college level classes. We're talking like economics, finances, English. There's a whole course on Bitcoin that me and my sons are going to take this year. There are courses on business. There are courses on history, geography, mathematics, physics, political science, you name it. But these are all like college level classes with amazing professors. And not only that,
Many of these classes are eligible to earn college credit by using the forms that they have on the website that allow you to submit those to accredited institutions to grant college credit back to you for this so-called Sailor Academy. It's called the Sailor Academy at sailor.org. Not only that, but you know what you got to pay for all this stuff? It's free. It's free to go take all these classes. It's shocking. We live in a cool era. Like, you would have to pay like tens of thousands of bucks to a university to get all this 10 years ago. It's all free. And, you know, for me as a guy who's, you know, I'm writing a book on parenting and education right now. I'm unschooling my kids, even though I don't like that word. Technically, it's a self-directed education. This is a gold mine. So check it out. It's sailor.org, sailor.org. I'll link to it in the show notes too. If you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/437, I'll link to it in the show notes. But it's a pretty cool website if you're into learning, which I think is great as a lifelong activity. So check that one out. And I think you'll like it quite a bit. Anyways, I think we're getting kind of long in the tooth. So I'm going to wrap things up. But everything I talked about, the podcast, the books, all the studies, everything, I'll put at bengreenfieldfitness.com/437. Happy Thanksgiving to those of you who are listening this close to Thanksgiving, even though I think it's coming out long after the turkey has actually been digested. But regardless, tuck away a few of my tips that I gave you for next Thanksgiving, especially some of that salt you can sprinkle on your food. And we now know that you're also just fine if you have some eggs along with your turkey dinner, if anybody actually does that. Sounds like something my sons would do. They have scrambled eggs with everything. It's our joke when we go out to restaurants. They take the leftovers in a box and say there's going to be great with scrambled eggs in the morning. So there you have it. All right, folks, I'm going to wrap this thing up. All the show notes are at bengreenfieldfitness.com/437. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/437. Have an amazing, amazing week. In compliance with the FTC guidelines, please assume the following about links and posts on this site. Most of the links going to products are often affiliate links, of which I receive a small commission from sales of certain items. But the price is the same for you, and sometimes I even get to share a unique and somewhat significant discount with you. In some cases, I might also be an investor in a company I mention. I'm the founder, for example, of Keon LLC, the makers of Keon-branded supplements and products, which I talk about quite a bit. Regardless of the relationship, if I post or talk about an affiliate link to a product, it is indeed something I personally use, support, and with full authenticity and transparency, recommend in good conscience. I personally vet each and every product that I talk about. My first priority is providing valuable information and resources to you that help you positively optimize your mind, body, and spirit. And I'll only ever link to products or resources, affiliate or otherwise, that fit within this purpose. So there's your fancy legal disclaimer.